to our beautiful deep community, I want to assure you the deeper is going nowhere. And the same incredible content will be released every week, but now through Arise. It is going to be less trauma heavy and more inspirational, uplifting, but it will still challenge and push you to grow. For all your deeper episodes, they are still available every fortnight. You can still get your deep hit with the deeper subscription.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Were you relieved when he died, not because of his suffering, but because of yours?
Yes. I don't even have to think about it. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Because of the crumbs, it was over. The chase was done.
Yes, I was free. I felt that so clearly in my bones, in my veins. I felt I am free.
Welcome to The Deep. I'm Zoe Marshall. In my early 20s, a lot of traumatic things happened. And ever since then, I have had this fascination with people and their stories. This is The Deep. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I work and live, and recognise their continuing connection to land, water, and community. I pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. This is a special episode. Comedian, media personality, and fellow podcaster Michelle Laurie joins me and we get real deep into her personal life. From her relationship with her dad to how she deals with trauma, all the way to raising kids. You probably haven't seen this side of Michelle, and I'm so glad she shared it with me. Enjoy. Michelle Laurie, welcome to The Deep.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here. I've been looking forward to this.
Oh, me too. You are one woman that is willing to go deep with me, I know for sure.
Yes.
You and I have something in common, and that is that we both have pretty heavy-duty podcasts.
Yeah.
And we were talking a little bit, and you brought up something really interesting, which was, you know, vicarious trauma from hosting a podcast like ours, right? In which ways have you felt fucked up by your work? And then how do you deal with that?
I find it really creeps up on me. I don't know about you, but I find I'm not sleeping or I'm just a bit sort of grumpy around the house. Or I think the ways that trauma creeps up on most people, or PTSD creeps up on most people, or I'll get really overly committed, or my perfectionism will really go nuts on it, you know, like I find I'm just, I'll be editing one episode for 5 days and just getting really pernickety about it and, you know, just realize, what are you doing? Like, it's fine. You don't have to go over it again and again and again. And yeah, that's, it's funny. It doesn't come up at the time. At the time I'm listening to something and I'm thinking it should be harder for me to listen to, or people will say to me, God, how do you? God, that's pretty full on. How do you listen? You know, how do you do that? And I'm like, no, it's fine. But then later it seems to affect my behavior and my sleep and things like that. How about you?
But you're not crying whilst it's happening or you're hearing something.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I did cry the other day actually, and I never, ever, ever do. But I think I'm tired. It's the end of a year. And this man I was talking to about the really, really intense domestic violence that he grew up with. And he was crying a lot. And I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. But that really sprung up on me. I was so shocked at myself. I don't like it when people cry, to be honest, on the news and that. I'm like, oh, God, hold it together, babes. Come on. It's your job.
Whereas for me, I don't like it. It's probably the first job where I haven't had to feel guarded and I can just be with them. And if I cry, I cry. And if I don't, I don't. It's not. But I have felt like certain episodes haunt me and I feel it in the moment. I feel them. It's almost like their energy attaches to me and it's pressing on my chest and on my throat. And we finish the episode and I can't get rid of the feeling. It just is in me. And then I can't stop thinking about it. And generally, it's usually, you know, the pedophilia episodes. Yeah. And there was one true crime ep about a woman that was broken into and stabbed multiple times and escaped and, you know, like just your worst nightmare. I mean, they're all my worst fucking nightmare, to be honest, but like this particular themes that just fuck me up so bad that I think it's actually, it does bleed into real life. You know, I walk into the schoolyard and I know the stats on child sexual assault.
I know what you mean. Do you find yourself looking around at that number of children and thinking?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I look at everybody, and I literally mean everybody as a pedophile.
Yeah.
No one is. Do you know? Like, it's just ruined parts of me and impacted my life where I don't, my child or children won't get the same freedoms or opportunities because I have that lens now and it is a non-negotiable and I don't fucking care if they miss out because I know too much. Do you feel like that?
Yeah.
Sometimes you just know too much.
It's funny, I don't feel that way, but sometimes a problem I have is dropping things into conversation with other people and they'll go, oh, God, you know too much.
Right.
You know, I have a bad habit of dropping stats or something like that into conversation and people go, oh, kind of, I didn't want to know that. And I guess I just don't think that way. I want to know everything. So, like, I just went to a forensics. Oh,
yes.
I saw you in Sydney when I was there for the forensics conference, you know. So, like, I want to know everything. I find it interesting. And so other people will go, I might tell them a little snippet I learned about autopsies, you know, and they'll be like, oh, I didn't really want to know that. Or, oh, you know, like, oh, God, you're into the weirdest things. But, like, I, you know, read coroner's reports for relaxation, you know.
so they don't stick to you as much as they stick to me. It's kind of more of a interest point versus a...
It is, but I have the same feeling at school. I definitely have the same feeling when I'm in an environment with lots of kids. Yeah, I think once you really internalize that and understand that and know that there's nothing you can do about it in that environment, that's really a really painful place to come from. And it makes me just think about people who work in those spaces. I remember being at the forensics place here in Melbourne one day working on something and two people were there who work in women's health and specifically in domestic violence, you know, they triage women who are just coming out of domestic violence or are still in it. And that morning in the news, a woman's body had been found somewhere in Victoria and they were talking about it. And I said to them, basically, I was like, oh, you know, what are you talking about? And they said, oh, we're just wondering if she's one of ours. And it really struck me that that's what they... We all read those stories and hear those stories, yeah, and we think, God, that's terrible, another one. But they think, is it one of ours? Do we know this woman? Has she come through our program? Do we work with her? You know, but they saddle up every day. They go back every day and try to help women and families, you know, get past this stuff. So
in this cycle.
Yeah. And some women, some families they assist and some they don't. But I, you know, those people to me are just so amazing how they do that. You meet women, you meet people who've worked in that business for 30, 40 years. So I think of it that way. Yeah. I think I can do a podcast. That's okay. I think I was brought up that way. I was brought up to be that, but that's how my family always operated. It's like someone's got it worse off than you. I always just think that. I think my poor children, I'm always saying to them, I saw families in India who lived on a blanket. You'll be fine. You know, like I'm always that person who thinks someone's got it worse than me. That's how I place it.
I love how we all tick. You know, I interviewed Mark Burris and we kind of got to a place where I said, you know, are you a psychopath because he doesn't feel certain things? And he openly was like, yeah, I guess in some ways, yeah. Like I just don't have that in me. And what I'm really learning is I feel too many things, you know,
yeah.
And it disturbs me too deeply. And it's a real privilege, right, to get to choose or switch in and out or feel disturbed and like carry that disturbance, but you're not living it in real time. And I think I want to finish off this and go into something else because I think you're going to have a really interesting perspective. But before I move on, do you think what we're doing is trauma porn?
Obviously I don't think so. If I thought it was, I wouldn't do it. For me personally, I do it because I think that holding a place for someone to tell their story is a valuable thing. And people tell me that, God, I've never been able to just sit and tell this whole story before. They talk about it being like, you know, people say when other people find out they've got cancer, suddenly people kind of don't talk to them or don't come and visit them because they don't know what to say. People say it's similar when you're the victim of a violent crime or you've lost a child to a violent crime or something like that, that you lose friends because people don't know how to relate to you anymore. And so just being able to sit and tell the whole story from your perspective and have someone listen is valuable. So there's that. And then to share that story, all of our guests have a reason why they want it shared. They come to us. I don't chase people. So, you know, some of them have built foundations that they want to let people know about. Some of them feel as though they haven't had justice and they want people to know about it. Also just sharing the process sometimes because I keep hearing from people how weird and awful the legal process is and all of those things. And I think, well, God forbid any of us go through that. I think it might be helpful if we kind of know what to expect a little bit. So I do think there's a purpose to it. I think there's a human purpose to sharing experience and to use that therapeutic term again, holding a place for each other and to listening, to letting people feel as though they've been heard. If they want to be heard, sit still and listen to them.
What do you think trauma porn is then?
I don't know. I suppose I don't. I've never thought about it because I think it's so awful and it's such an awful term and I spend most of my time trying to think of all the reasons why I'm not it. I think, you know, there's websites where you can go and look at the remains of someone who's been in a car accident with no context. I guess that's trauma porn.
Yeah.
And we're not doing that, you know. I guess there's a difference.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know. I don't think it's trauma porn.
I think it's funny, you know, there's this cycle of disrespect for true crime, certainly. And I certainly understand where victims aren't respected in true crime. I don't like that. I don't like podcasts where people are drunk and joking around true crime. I'm not into that genre. But just the other day, my producer contacted a journalist at the ABC and to invite them on to the show and got a really scathing reply about what we do. how this person didn't want to be involved in what we do in true crime. And we were like, wow. Firstly, unnecessary. It was an invitation. You could just say no, thanks.
No, thanks.
No, thanks. And secondly, you know, what we do, I don't think is dissimilar to what he does. Like, really and truly, reporting crime in a newspaper or on the news is true crime. You know, yeah. We go more in depth with victims and victims' families and offenders and investigators. That's all we do.
We often speak to people who have been impacted by narcissists. And both you and I have been impacted by narcissists in our family units and in partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have any lessons for us, specifically, like, I'm going through something now with somebody who I have had in my life for decades, but has always given me crumbs, right? It's always been crumbs.
Yeah.
But I am so desperate for anything that I've taken them for so long. And then there's ghosting, right? It's like crumbs, ghost, and me allowing with open arms every time, like, I'll take whatever you've got, you know? So I'm enabling, which I completely get. And then I've realized the impacts of how much this is fucking me up. And I'm in this funny place of, I have to choose myself, but doing that means there's not even any crumbs anymore. It's going to be grieving. Yeah. It's going to be an ending. For someone like you that has experienced what I'm talking about, what did you do and how did you cope, and do you ever actually get through it?
That's the question. That's a really good question. Do you ever actually get through it? My father was a narcissist, and so I was raised on this crumbs, ghosting paradigm and chasing the chase. I'm the chaser. You're always going to stay just far enough away. And if you, with a hint that you might give me something, you might. So don't ever stop chasing me, because you never know. You never know. The minute you stop chasing me, that might be the day when I was going to turn around and love you. So, you know, you don't want to give up. So, definitely then that bled into my adult relationships with men. So that's the cycle I'm trying desperately to change at the moment. I feel like hopefully now I'm aware of it, and that's quite a new thing, to see it that clearly and be aware of it. Hopefully that will help me get into a relationship with somebody different. So at the moment I'm just lonely because I'm not chasing anyone for the first time in my life, but hopefully someone will wander along. But definitely, I don't know about you, but in the last relationship, I was sort of coming, I was realizing, because the great thing about the last relationship was that I was in counseling at the same time. So we were working through it in real time. My counselor, James, and I, I'd be going, okay, this has happened, and this text and that email and then this, you know, outing, and he'd be going, right. And we were working through it in real time. It was very educational. And but I realized I wanted to win. I knew I had to get out of the relationship, and I knew it was ending, and I knew all of that, but I wanted to win it. It became quite competitive. Who was going to win this scenario? And that sort of kept me in it for a while. And so accepting that there doesn't need to be a win, just get out. You're a winner if it stops. You're a winner if you can break the cycle. Give up on the crumbs, give up on there ever being any more than crumbs, give up on the idea that it will ever change, that there will be a magical day, that anything you ever do will be enough. That was the hard part.
Did your father treat your children and your mother the same with the crumbs?
No, definitely not my mum. No, and I don't think he treated my children that way either. He was very selfish. He was very much the centre of the family, and it was always about him wherever we went for any occasion. Everyone's birthday was about him. It was about where he wanted to go, what he wanted to do was always about him. And I think we all just accepted that. I don't know. I think, and I'd love to speak to my siblings about it, but they're not, I don't think they'd be up for this conversation yet. But maybe it was just me. Maybe they had similar relationships with him. I'm not sure. But certainly not my mum.
Were you relieved when he died, not because of his suffering, but because of yours?
Yes. I don't even have to think about it. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Because of the crumbs, it was over. The chase was done.
Yes, I was free. I felt that so clearly in my bones, in my veins. I felt I am free for the first time in 48 years or 47, whatever it was. I'm free of this relationship that's been going my whole life, and I felt it. I felt free. And that was my overwhelming feeling.
Was it your chase for crumbs that had you house him in his final months, years?
I definitely think that was part of it. Also, it was. I mean, he never gave me, I felt, an option to say no to him. You just didn't say no to him. And he was in a position where he was vulnerable, and I was the only person who could stop he and my mum from being physically separated, because he needed to go really to a nursing home, and mum couldn't go because she was well. So they would have been separated. And I knew, okay, well, I just need to move heaven and earth, do whatever it takes to prevent that from happening. But you're right, it was constant. It was constant. It was like whatever he needs, whatever he wants, I'll just provide. Whether it's $50 to go to the bowls club or a granny flat. Yeah, I felt helpless. I felt like, yes. Yeah. So see what I mean about the freedom of that being over?
Oof, it just feels like someone... And I get it, because I'm an anxiously attached human that is attracted to avoidance for a very obvious reason. But to have them, I mean, it's such a crescendo moment, and put yourself again so far on the back burner after so many years being on the back burner. Feels like kind of an insane thing to do, even if you were the last one to do it. Like someone, another person might go, you know what, Mum, it's just shitty luck to be separated, but you can visit every day, or you can come stay here, or like, do you know what I mean? Some like,
yeah,
strong boundaries. Totally. And you were just like, I'll take it. One more go on the roller coaster ride of life with Dad, you know?
I know, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And did
I mean,
that...
I think I am a person. I am a person who I do extraordinary things. I know I do. I do say, no, I think it can be done, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to prove it can be done, and I'm going to do it. And I get annoyed when people just immediately say, can't be done, whether it's fitting something in the boot of the car or, you know, whatever it is. I'm like, get out of the way. I'll do it myself, because it can be done and I will do it.
How long was it?
That he lived with us?
Yeah.
I think it was 3 years.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was a long time. And then it was progressive, you know. It was like harder and harder, ambulances more and more often. Very, very traumatic, very, very difficult. Even if you liked the guy, it would have been difficult. You know?
Did it damage you?
Yeah, it definitely changed me It definitely changed me as a person, and it changed the kids. I think we came out of it, and then we came out of that and straight into COVID pretty much.
Oh.
So, right. So I got to a point maybe a year and a bit ago where I realized, you know what, we're not the optimists we used to be, kids. We're kind of pessimistic. We're kind of planning for the worst all the time, and we're not the joyful people we used to be. So we've spent the last year really pulling ourselves out of that. And I think it has worked to a large extent, but I realized that it had definitely changed the three of us. We were not the same.
Was it worth it?
I don't think in terms of things in the past being worth it or not, because there's nothing I can do about them. You know, I try not to have regrets. I'm a big believer in that idea that when you're depressed, it's because you're living in the past, and when you're anxious, it's because you're living in the future, you know? And I'm a Buddhist, and I try very much to live in the now, in the moment. And so, yeah, I actively don't like to think. I think everything's worth it. Everything just is. Everything's part of where I am right now and got me here talking to you. So that's good. That's worth it, you know?
Did he say I love you? Did he say I'm sorry?
No. Nope. Lots of rewriting of his. He used to lie a lot and used to say hilarious things like, well, that's why I always told you when you were young, you could do anything you want. And I'd think, oh, you never told me that. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? You never told me that. So, yeah, no apologies.
So it wasn't necessarily a healing opportunity?
It was, to be honest with you, I felt like I'm a better person than he was, and that proved it.
I think I could have told you even if you didn't take him in.
Thank you. But I proved it to myself. There were times when I used to think, and I used to say to my mum, I don't know who's going to die first, to be honest. I don't know if it's going to be him or me, because this is fucking killing me. But you know, I'm glad that I got through it. It was took a lot. But, yeah, I guess I am glad. I am glad. It proved to myself and that I'm the better person. I took better care of him than he took of me.
I had a friend give me some really sage advice, which was, if you lack matriarchs in the family or leaders or elders, and there is a situation like yours that occurs, you are called to be the elder, regardless of your age, and to look at the situation holistically and go, I have to have my needs met, but look after the rest of the family's needs all at once.
Mm-hmm.
But in turn, which is what I feel like you did, but in turn, a psychologist said, if your children witness the way your parents treat you, right, it is a learning moment for them of how to treat others, you know, or how you you yourself as the child can allow being treated. Do you feel like they witnessed any of that nuance, or was that more your own thing? Like from their eyes, it would have just been, oh, that's granddad, you know?
Oh, I think particularly my daughter's very, very, very conscious. She picks up a lot, and also we talk a lot. It's funny, I didn't consciously choose to raise them in a certain way or speak to them in a certain way. It's just how I am and how they are. And like, I'll give you an example. I forgot to tell them about Santa when they were little.
Which bit?
I just completely forgot. All of it. I completely
like from
forgot.
From when they were two, you didn't even say Santa's
yes,
coming.
I forgot. I forgot. So they came home
Thanks,
from
lots
kinder.
Of, there's lots of reminders.
I know, right? But it just never occurred to me. So they came home from kinder and they went, oi, what's Santa? Like, what's going on? Who is Santa? What's happening? Everyone else is getting presents from Santa. And I went, oh, shit, I'm so sorry. I forgot about Santa. So they're four. And they said, well, are we getting presents from him? And I went, sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're getting presents from Santa. And then they said, is he real? And I said, yeah. You know, like Dora the Explorer's real. He's real like that. And they went, okay, whatever. So I've always spoken to them very honestly, is what I'm trying to say. And, like, I didn't have the heart to lie to them at that stage. So when it comes to their grandparents, we've spoken very openly, and about their father for that matter, who's a whole other kettle of fish, but who they haven't seen in 2 years. And that's very heartbreaking for them. Yeah, so we speak very honestly, and I've spoken to them about my dad and about why it was important for me to take care of him. Also because I think you take care of people, you take care of your family up to a point, not when they're abusive and, you know, which is the case with their dad, to be honest. Not when it's dangerous, but by that stage my father was desperately in need of help. Also, I did it for my mum. I mean, my mum was orphaned at 9 when her mum took her own life. My mum was punted around before that to relatives and orphanages with nuns who belted the shit out of her. Like, you know, I did it for her. Talk about matriarch. So, you know, to me, I don't know how much, I don't know how it weighs up between what you talk about and what they observe, but certainly we've talked a lot about why I thought it was important to bring Nan and Pop home with us. Same reason it's important that we have a blind chicken in the backyard. Same reason we have rescue kittens. You know, same reason. I think it's important to take care of people and things who need help, you know, if you can. If you can, if it's not at your expense, if it's not dangerous.
Did they mention, or have they said, because they're at teens now, did they say that they, you know, oh, the way Pop talks to you, or do they see any of that?
They didn't see it, no. To them, okay. He was just a funny old character. But I have spoken to them a bit about it since then, about my childhood and just funny little things. Now they think everything is harsh from your childhood. They think, you know, walking on hot sand without thongs is incredibly harsh childhood memory, you know. So, but sometimes I'll tell them, you know, bits and pieces. I can't remember even what it was, but we saw a scene in a movie the other night and I said, oh, God, that reminds me of my childhood. And they were like, ooh. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I just share bits and pieces with them that way. I think it's good.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
I don't know if it's too much, but could we talk about, just in context of you mothering with an absent father currently, how do you, manage that level of disappointment and inconsistency and, like, how?
Again, with honesty, that's the only way I know how. And so, you know, when I'm overwhelmed, in fact, I've learned that from them. They're really good at saying I'm overwhelmed. And I've learned that from them. I've learned that sometimes I'll behave in a way, if I find myself screaming at them to throw their dirty clothes down the stairs because I've asked 3 times and they're still not down there, and I'm just going off my tits about it, and then I'll realize, oh, I'm overwhelmed. And I express it the way they do and just say to them, guys, I'm overwhelmed. Please help me, you know, and they will help me. And they'll say, one of them might say to me, oh, Mum, sorry, we know it's hard. It's just you. You know, it's just you here looking after us. Yeah. So I find the more honest I am, then they will come back to me with compassion and everything works better. if I can remember.
How do you be honest about why a dad doesn't see them? How do you be honest about that?
I am honest about that as much as I know why. I'm honest about his addiction issues. I'm honest about what I think is going on. I'm honest about where I think it's come from. I think it's come from childhood trauma that he can't cope with at the moment, that he's just not strong enough to cope with. And obviously it's not their fault. It's not my fault that we tried. The hard part for me is that they don't have the great memories that I have, because we were together for 11 years before I had the twins. And so I had a lifetime of memories of this brilliant person. And so I'm constantly sharing those memories with him, just because they pop up with them about him, because they pop up, little things will happen. I'll see something on TV or something will happen and I'll go, oh gosh, your dad and I used to do this, or we went there, or it was so funny. He said, and they just kind of, sometimes they'll say, oh, I wish we knew him then, because it was a very different person. But, you know, you and I have spoken about this a little bit, about how having children can really bring up childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that happened in our case, and so he just wasn't able to bring it back in. Not yet. Not yet.
His kids brought up his trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, becoming a father really rocked him. Yeah.
That's fucking terrible, you know?
It is. It's really terrible, yeah. So, I mean, I haven't given up hope. Where there's life, there's hope, they say. But certainly at the moment it's pretty dire. And the kids are getting to that age where they're like, well, maybe I don't ever want to give him another chance. So that's up to them, of course.
When was that last, like, when did you break up?
Sort of, it was a long, long breakup, because I mean, us as a couple, probably 4 years ago, but we still tried to be a family as much as you can, you know? So that was 2 years ago, 2 years since they've seen him. He left town.
Wow. Yeah. When I hear these stories as a parent, right, and as someone that has had different levels of neglect, I get addicts in that way of, like, how do they live with it? Well, they don't. They just are coping with whatever to get through it. But you just think, in those real quiet moments in between, where they actually have a little bit of sense or presence, you just go, how? How do you keep choosing that, you know, over your own shit?
I think in a lot of cases, and I suspect in this one, there's a lot of projection onto other people and a lot of blame onto other people, a lot of convincing yourself that other people are to blame, you're being kept from seeing your kids, you know, none of which is true. But I think you have to convince yourself that it's not you.
To survive. Because,
yeah, to survive. The demon's too big and scary to take on, so you project it all onto easier targets, you know.
It's a lot being a single mum. I'm not a single mum, but I had a single mum. Mm. And to watch that overwhelm and the multiple jobs and all the roles and the single mums to me are like nurses and teachers, like fucking heroes, you know, to be able to, like, just keep going, just keep fucking turning up, like, day after day, with the washing and the lunches and the dinners and the chit chat and the fucking, you know, like
the chit chat. Chit chat.
The hormones in your case.
Oh my God. You know? But you're a great example. I mean, I just keep reminding myself of so many people I love and think are the duck's nuts were raised by single mums. Like, so many of my favorite people were raised by single mums. And And I look at my kids and they are great, you know, and they are kind and they will say those great things to me like, oh, you know, you're only one person, Mum. It's okay. You know, they'll sort of parrot back to me things that I've screamed at them, but they'll say them back in a much nicer way. You're not an octopus, they used to say to me when they were little, because that's what I used to say to them. I'm not an octopus. And I think, yeah, these are the benefits. There's something really compassionate and sweet about kids who are raised by single mums, which is no offence to dads, obviously. But I don't know, they're kind to me. I guess they worry. I guess deep in their souls they think, well, we can't lose her too. If we lose her, we got nothing. So we best try and keep her in some shape.
100%. 100%. 100%. And, like, that is my truth, you know, is, like, I don't have really my dad and I don't have a mum. She passed and I'm an only child. And so it's a scary thing. Like, I remember holding on to my mum and begging her to never die and never leave me. Like every day, just don't die. You can never die. And then it was almost like a manifestation that I'd had all of this fear to lose this person. And it was like we were too, the relationship and the love was just so mighty. It was too good to be true that I just knew in the back of my heart that she was going to go too soon, you know? And so I get that for them. There's always going to be that thing of like, we've got to keep her healthy. She's got to keep her steps up. We've got to
Totally. You know? And because I'm a bit older, you know, I was 37 when I had them. So Louis sometimes says, oh, I wish you'd had me when you were younger. Oh, I wish, you know, he has these ideas.
I need more time.
Yeah, about how long I'm going to last. So I keep saying, oh, don't worry about me, mate. I'll live forever. Don't worry.
Oh, my gosh. Just to go full circle, you have been trolled. And whether that is you're a media personality or an everyday person, people get bullied in lots of different places and in different ways. Teens, you know, we're seeing it all the time. What coping mechanisms or strategies did you use when it was really bad? And before you answer that, how bad was bad? Give me an example.
How bad was bad? The worst part of it, and I've spoken to lots of other women in similar situations, is that it comes at you so fast and the volume is so intense. People are it's like machine gun fire. It's like you're looking at your phone and it's just like bang, 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 accusation and misquoting and threats and just offensive stuff. And so you're trying to reply, and that's mistake number one. Obviously, I've learned that. Don't try and reply. Just ignore it because
don't feed them.
No, don't feed the trolls. But initially, you know, you try and correct someone, say something, you go, no, I didn't say that. And then that just sets off a whole other explosion. It's like everything you reply sets off another explosion. And because I think another problem is as a comedian, I was always really good at comebacks. So I'm actually quite good at slapping people down. So someone will say something to me and I'll just go smash and slap them down. Oh, my God. Then suddenly they're fucking so offended. I'm like, excuse you fucking came for me? Are you joking? You are a stranger and you just offended me. You just called me something or other. And then when I slap you back, then you're like, oh, Michelle, how dare you speak to somebody like that? What? So then suddenly you've got hundreds of and there's other strangers chiming in going, I can't believe you spoke to a person like that. Did you see what they said to me? So that, you know, so then that's exploding. And then, yeah, in amongst it, there's someone saying, you know, you should be dead. You need a good cock in your mouth. You need all that kind of stuff. But I've got to tell you, there's a funny story to this. There is a funny story. One night, I can't remember what it was about. I just remember somehow I'm standing in my kitchen, my old house. I can see it very clearly. I got my laptop out. This guy had been sending really vile messages to me and he'd taken to DMs, which happens quite a bit. They'll just suddenly decide, no, I'm just going to send her some personal messages and call her a slut and a fat slut and whatever else. Anyway, so I started replying to him, but quite calmly. Replying, okay, what's your caper? Like, who are you? What are you talking about? What's going on? So he starts replying back. We end up having this back and forth. And it turns out it had nothing to do with the project or whatever we started at. It turned out he was a fan of Spicks and Specks. It's a completely different show. And he said he reckoned the comedians ruined it. He just reckoned they should be more music on Spicks and Specks and less comedians.
Wow. And so I'm going for you.
Yeah, I think he was in Warrnambool. He's just a really lonely guy living alone. He's middle-aged, 50 or 60, in Warrnambool, lonely guy. He's like, that's my only joy in my life is Spicks and Specks. And then they have a really good old rocker like Ross Wilson on there, and then they have you on there chiming in, telling jokes. And I was like, yeah, well, that's what they pay me to do that. And like, oh, I don't just rock up and knock on the gate and ask if I could come in and ruin Spicks and Specks. And so, I mean, that's the mentality you're dealing with a lot of the time, is just people just blowing off steam, just – and that was that was a breakthrough for me. I thought, God, this is fascinating. This guy doesn't even hate me. He doesn't even hate what's happened on the project. He doesn't – he's not – he's just, I don't know, on his couch entertaining himself.
And this isn't a me thing. This is a you thing.
You realise that a lot of trolling is just people entertaining themselves. It's people on the couch or in bed. They don't see you as a person. They're not really engaged in the argument. They're just entertaining themselves. And once you realise that, you realise, oh, well, then I'm not going to be there punching back. I'm just going to watch something else, do something else. You know,
has it made you cry? Not Spicks and Specks guy, but has it?
Oh yeah, oh absolutely. There have been nights when I just around that time. That was when it was at its worst, because around the time my father was at the end of his life, because the pressure in life in general was so intense, and something happened. Can't remember what it was. It's a huge blow up. My social media went crazy, and I was beside myself. There's nothing I could say. I couldn't apologize. I tried everything on social media. No, they weren't having it. Just went for days and days and days. And out of nowhere, I got a DM from Georgie Gardner. Now, at the time, Georgie Gardner was on the Today Show. I think it was when Carl had left. And so she was taking a ton of shit. People saying, the show's terrible, get rid of her.
It was two women, wasn't it? Yeah. And they were like... Yeah. Yes.
She and Deb Knight. And out of nowhere, I got the loveliest DM from Georgie Gardner, who I don't know, just saying, hey, hang in there. Don't worry about it. It's just such bullshit, da da da. And I just was really touched. I thought, what a beautiful person. So then I had already agreed to do a podcast with somebody about something else. And I just mentioned it on there and I said, hey, I just want to give a shout out to Georgie Gardner, you know, because she sent me this lovely message. And I said, the whole process made me think about, you know, how much social media gets to you when your real life is hard, when you're under a lot of pressure. So what I said on this podcast was that it made me think about Charlotte Dawson and how when Charlotte would get into these huge online Barney's on Twitter, I was one of the people who would message Charlotte and say, Charlotte, just ignore them. Who cares? Who gives a fuck about these losers? Turn your phone off. Go and do it. You're fabulous. Go and do something fabulous. And she couldn't. She couldn't disengage and she got so upset. And after she took her life, we realized that she had a lot going on in her actual life. So it made me realize how if you're feeling great, if your life's going really well, it's easy to dismiss social media and those strangers. But when you're under a lot of pressure, it seems bigger, seems more important, you know. So I said this on this podcast. Next minute, the Daily Mail writes an article saying that Georgie Gardner had stopped me taking my own life. Right? I thought it was laughable.
Right.
ABC Radio in Melbourne cancelled a job that I was supposed to start. I was supposed to, they dropped me. People started ringing me and texting me going, are you okay, mate? I'm like, it's the Daily Mail. I didn't even say that. It's a complete, it's a complete misquote. I never said that. Then like 3 years later, my kids came home from school saying, and they'd been, had an assignment at school to Google their parents. My kids walk in the door and go,
no.
Yeah. We found this thing saying you were going to kill yourself, but this some lady told you not to. I was like, oh, my God. No, that never happened. That never, none of that ever happened. So.
But shout out to Georgie anyway. Shout out.
Beautiful person. What a beautiful person. I mean that to the end of time. That's all I wanted to do was give her a shout out.
You made me think of something. You know these moments that you have where you say something to a situation or an individual or whatever, but your loyal, diehard fans jump the bandwagon and start tearing that person, individual, or situation apart.
Yep.
Is there a responsibility on you, because you've been there at the bottom of the barrel, to be mindful? Or and what do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think so. And in the past, in the early days, I would kind of set people on to somebody else. Way back in the early days.
Nasty.
I mean, like as part of.
Get him, Rex.
But when I say somebody else, I would mean like on a news show or on a, you know, like I would.
Yes.
An individual. But I would say, you know, I would at someone that I meant, you know, has lied in their news story about this person or whatever group. So, I definitely did. And then there was a point years ago now where people started saying, hey, that's a bit crook to like set your followers on a person. I thought, yeah, that is actually, that's really crook. But yeah, definitely it happens. And
you're a Buddhist, so you know karmically.
Absolutely.
This is like a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I still stand by, you know, setting people on a lying newscast. That doesn't bother me as a Buddhist one bit. But, yeah, definitely it still happens to me. It still happens to me a lot where I'll, you know, for weeks end up with messages, DMs from someone's fans talking rubbish. But, again, usually I will engage to a certain point. I'll write back politely and say, listen, this is why. But then after that, it's like, it's up to you guys. It's up to you.
It's really tricky. I've only had a couple of situations because I try and steer clear of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have that constitution. But there was a situation where I interviewed a pedophile hunter, and he is quite controversial. And quite the, how do I say, you know, he's kind of a rogue warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this troll and her trollettes come for me.
Mm.
And I tried to do the thing, which was really understand her point of view, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
And there was, you were right, there was no, she didn't want to be heard. She didn't want to be understood. She didn't want anything. And so in the end, I just had to delete all comments and mute and block and do the thing, because I am the person I want to hear. If I am wrong, I will rectify.
Yeah.
But I will never just, I think, you know, I worry for that sense of people bullying, depression, spiraling, all of that stuff, and having any part of it freaks me out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And also I get bored with people just coming at me with slogans, like just coming at me, you know, calling me a gatekeeper and, you know, just like their whatever sloganeering at me. I'm like, okay, what does it, like if you want to come and speak like a human being, then I'm open to that. But don't come at me with what my son calls slurs, you know, the contemporary accusations that are just like so boring. I'm just not interested in any of that. Just if you want to speak, I'll speak. I'm happy to have a conversation. But accusing me of being everything from a TERF to a gatekeeper, not into that.
Our final question.
Mm.
Who are you when no one's watching?
Oh, cat lady, that's easy. That's easy. I'm always in pajamas. I'm one of those ladies. Always, you know, getting around, or actually I'm usually getting around in bike shorts and a black singlet. And I'm just chatting with cats and dogs and pretending they're talking back to me. I'm that person. And you know, I mean, look, I'm definitely, I would have this conversation you and I have had with my daughter. I'd try and have it with my son, but he would roll his eyes at some point and go, ugh, you know, and get bored and leave. He's funny though. He's like, ever since he was probably 8 or 9, he's just taken a stand against things like politics on TikTok and things like that. He's like, ugh, shouldn't be allowed to have this on TikTok. It's like, should be fun. Should just be, you know, he's that guy. He's like, ah, I don't want to talk about
this. I agree.
Yeah, he's that guy. He's like,
I agree.
This is my relaxation time. This is not BTN. You know, that's his attitude. He's like, ah, it's like living in BTN with Living With You People. But it's behind the news for those of you listeners who don't have children at school. It's BTN now. So, yeah, but I'm just me. I'm just the same lady but with more cat hair on me than you may realise.
There's some on your mic.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's absolutely. I'm glad you can see that. Yeah, look, it's terrible.
Thank you for being here with us.
No, thank you. I wish you were my next door neighbour.
I know, it'd be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be great. It would be lovely.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Deep. If it's left you with any burning questions for me or our guests, please hit us up by direct message on Instagram at What's the Deep.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, everybody. It is Zoe here. Change is coming to the deep. I want to welcome you to Arise. It's uplifting. It's quirky, it's curious, it's all about the mindset and self-discovery to be more helpful and of service. During 16 of the Deep, you'll hear some of these episodes and I'd love to hear what you think of them over on our Instagram at What's the Deep.